Hello, this is Jane, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 4 issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. First article is from the first page, and it's under the byline of Education, and the headline reads, EQAO results reveal little progress. Small student gains prompt review of standardized testing. And this is by Kristen Rashoi and Isabel Teotanio. With only slight gains in reading, writing, and math scores, the education minister is ordering a full review of standardized testing in the province, saying student achievement is not improving fast enough. This is not acceptable. It's not acceptable to parents. It's not acceptable to me, Paul Calandra said Wednesday after the Education Quality and Accountability Office released its latest results weeks later than usual on his behest. After poring over the data, Calandra said he was frustrated and decided to appoint two $1,500 a day advisors to look into the test, stalled scores, how schools can better use EQAO results, and see if there are any additional resources teachers and students need. But with half of grade 6 students and 42% of grade 9 students not meeting the expected standard, roughly a B grade or better, in math, critics said it's time to boost funding and resources for schools. It was clear why the minister kept the scores hidden. They're not great, particularly in math, when 2 out of 5 grade 9 students aren't meeting the provincial standard, and half of grade 6 students are failing to meet it, said NDP education critic Chandra Pasma. While Toronto parent Katerina Matheson believes the minister's alarm about Ontario kids failing to meet the benchmarks is warranted, she said, "I don't think you need to be paid $1,500 per day to figure out that the new curriculum wasn't implemented with sufficient deployment of curricular materials or an adequate budget and plan for teacher training and retraining to be successful." In grade 3, the percentage of students meeting or exceeding the provincial standard in the 2024-25 school year climbed to 64% in math, up 3 percentage points from 2023-24. 74% in reading, also up 3 points, and 65% in writing, up 1 point. In grade 6, 51% met the standard in math, up 1 point, 86% in reading, up 4 points, and 85% in writing, up 5 points. On the grade 9 math test, 58% met the standard, up 4 points, and among first-time students taking the grade 10 literacy test, 85% met the standard. Despite the small increases, Calandra said he was still really taken aback by the results and needed time to do a deep dive before they were made public. Calandra is already in the midst of a large shakeup in education, taking control of an unprecedented 6 boards and introducing legislation making it easier to seize power from trustees, as well as an overhaul of how boards are governed, possibly eliminating elected officials in public boards. While additional government funding for math specialists in each school has helped, that program could instead prioritize low-scoring ones, said Matheson, co-chair of the Parent Involvement Advisory Committee at Toronto's Public School Board. Despite renewed calls from teacher unions to scrap the tests, Calandra said that's not part of his plan, adding that we should be able to get results sooner and more often, so that will also be part of the review. At the same time, the province is looking at school board governance. He noted that boards have used additional math resources in different ways, with varying results. No legislation will be tabled this year about possibly eliminating trustees, he said. But to be clear, there is absolutely nothing to date that has moved me from where I have been for months that trustees aren't necessarily the right avenue to deliver education across the province of Ontario. On the testing review, Kathleen Woodcock, president of the Ontario Public School Boards Association, said it has long supported EQAO and the value of provincial assessment. It is a key planning tool to assist in moving the system forward. However, she added, there should be nothing political about student assessment. It is our hope that this objective approach continues in Ontario. David Mastin, president of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, said the EQAO is supposed to operate as an arm's-length independent agency. Why is the minister intervening in decisions around the release of its results? While the government says the $43 billion it is spending on education is the highest it's been, boards and unions say it has not kept up with inflation in most years and doesn't cover actual costs. Calandra, however, noted that with similar per student funding levels, some boards have much stronger results, and said COVID, no doubt, played a role in this, but it shouldn't be used as the excuse of the results that we're seeing. Both the Toronto Public and Catholic boards saw gains, but grade 3 math results at 61% at each board were 3 percentage points below the provincial average. At the troubled Near North District School Board, which Calandra took over this week after a ministry investigation found dysfunctional leadership by both the director and trustees, results were well below the provincial average. Calandra used the North Bay-based board to bolster his argument that dysfunctional leadership contributes to poor scores, as just 60% of grade 3 students there met the standard in reading, 43% in writing, and 49% in math. Results dipped further in grade 6 math, where only 29% met the standard, and only about a third of grade 9 students reached the provincial benchmark. They have some of the most horrific results in province, because they spend too much time fighting each other and not enough time focusing on students, Calandra said. We've seen this in many different boards across the province. All right, the next article is also from the front page under the byline of courts. The headline reads, "He is suddenly going to die and I'm going to jail." Caretakers exchanged chilling texts months before boy's death. This is by Jacques Gallant. 1 month before he was found dead in his prospective adoptive mother's Burlington basement, a 12-year-old boy was showing symptoms of something seriously wrong, so much so that one of the women texted the other, "Unfortunately, my thoughts are he is suddenly going to die and I'm going to jail." A month later, on December 21, 2022, the boy was found unresponsive and soaking wet in the basement of Brandy Cooney and Becky Hamber's home. The Crown at the couple's first-degree murder trial has alleged the couple despised the boy and left him to die. In the last year of his life, he suffered the effects of severe malnutrition, which Humber blamed him for. Since Monday, the trial has been viewing hundreds of pages of disturbing text messages exchanged between the women about the boy and his younger brother, who were placed in their care by the Children's Aid Society in 2017 and whom they were planning to adopt. In the texts, the women used insulting and dehumanizing language to refer to the boys, including the terms it, dick, a-hole, loser, and more. In one November 2022 text exchange between Hamber and Cooney, presented in court on Wednesday, Cooney tells her wife that she believes the boy may need a hospital and expresses her concern about going to jail. She reports that he's shaking, he's not speaking English, appears drunk, and there's something wrong with his eyes. They look high as an effing kite. Hamber responds that the boy is a faker, but suggests Cooney flash a light in his eyes and ask him if his head hurts. Hamber says he probably just needs to go to the bathroom and should nap. He is literally starving and dehydrated, Hamber said. She had also told Cooney in a text that the boy was malnourished due to his own, shitty choices. The defense has blamed the boy's dramatic weight loss before his death on his eating habits, which included repeatedly regurgitating undigested or partially digested food. No sleep, starving, dehydrated, and no poo. The perfect storm, Hamburg texted. She asked Cooney to tell the boy to stop fake shivering, please, only to then say that she believes he's hypothermic. Cooney texts that maybe she's just panicking and that it's scary to see the boy like this. Do you think he's dying or hit rock bottom and isn't dying? Cooney asks her wife. Unsure, Hamber replies. Sergeant Julie Powers of Halton Regional Police, the officer in charge of the case, testified Wednesday that there are no records from around that time in November 2022 suggesting that the boy received medical attention. The court has previously heard the boy was ultimately seen by a doctor 8 days before his death. Superior Court Justice Clayton Conlon, who is hearing the case without a jury, frequently asked the Crown and Powers to pause so he could take notes about the texts, especially when Powers was reading out the November 2022 exchanges. As they have throughout the four-month trial, the accused women sat in separate prisoners' boxes at the Milton Courthouse in their green jail uniforms and could often be seen taking notes. Documents indicate that between October 2021 and September 2022, they received $1,035 a month for each boy from the Children's Aid Society in Ottawa, where the brothers were originally from. The Ottawa Children's Aid Society remained the legal guardian until the older boy's death. Court was also shown a text, exchange between September 2022 between Cooney and her father, Ed, who had been helping the couple with the boys regarding the deceased boy not scrubbing something properly. He doesn't even come close to any abso-effing-galutely useless, Ed Cooney texted, asking his daughter what he should do when the boy is done. She replies that the boy should be sent to his room, tell him to clean his floor, send it to the stairs when done. Powers testified that the it in send it to stairs refers to the boy. The trial has heard evidence that both brothers, whose identities are covered by a publication ban, were made to walk up and down stairs as a form of punishment. They were also made to wear wetsuits that were zip-tied, sleep inside tents in their rooms that were also zip-tied, and drank out of baby bottles. Those forms of restraint were discussed freely between the women and with Cooney's father in text messages. May I have zip ties? Can I restrain this bastard till he shuts up? Cooney texted Hamber in March 2022 without it being specified which boy she was talking about. I want to punch this bastard. In April 2022, Cooney texted her father asking, "Do you mind getting the F-face up for me?" And Ed Cooney responded, "Sure, zip ties off, correct?" A still image taken from a surveillance camera in the deceased boy's room showed him in May 2022 sleeping curled up in a ball on what appeared to be a sheet on the floor, inside a zip-tied tent, with no blanket on his body. The room appeared empty otherwise. 3 months later, in August 2022, the women complained to each other that he was still sleeping in that position. I brought up to the boy that we continue to tell him to take care of his body. And look how you sleep. Better choices, funner life, Cooney texted Hamburg. Loser bag still in S-F-ball. They're blanking out the swear words. Dumba, I love you tons. Hamburg responded, "Yeah, he was sleeping like a bag of crap all night again. Such a dick. I love you too." These are quotes. In September 2022, the women were texting each other about one of the boys soiling his underwear, prompting Cooney to write, "I really just want to murder," to which Hamburg replied, "No, S-." The comment prompted Conlon, the judge, to ask Powers if there was any evidence as to which boy the women were talking about. Powers said it's her interpretation that the conversation was about the deceased boy because Cooney referred at the start of the chat to the loser downstairs, which is where the boy's bedroom was located. The following month, Hamburg discovered that the younger brother, who was about 9 years old, had told a therapist about his shoes and hands being zip-tied. "We are defo getting a CIS call," she told Cooney. The therapist just keeps going and going, asking and asking. "We're F... ED. Cooney emphasized to Hamburg that the restraints were for the boy's own good so they didn't hurt themselves. Court has heard evidence that they had experienced trauma from a young age and developed behavioral issues and were prone to outbursts that were sometimes violent. Hamburg said that whether they get in trouble will depend on the therapist's interpretation of what the boy told her. "Shows he will tell anyone anything. Effing a-hole," Hamburg texted. "CAS doesn't care," Cooney responded. "We do what we can and get called S-abusers, and then I might kill him." The trial continues. I need to pause for a moment to remind you that you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The next article I'm reading is also from the front page under the byline Federal Politics. And the title reads, "Carney Hate Crimes Law Faces Crucial Test. Block may hinge support for Bill C-9 on removing shield for religious opinions." And this is by Mark Ramsey. Ottawa. The Carney government's effort to pass its proposed law to combat rising hate crimes faces a critical test this week. With the Liberals looking for a partner in the minority parliament on Bill C-9, the Bloc Quebecois appear to be hinging its support on a contentious push to remove a shield for religion-based opinions in some of Canada's already existing hate speech laws. The new bill has already been roundly criticized by opposition parties as well as left and right-wing critics. And the Bloc's proposal has escalated criticism from conservatives and some Muslim and Christian groups who decried it as an attack on freedom of religion and expression. With the bloc's support, Liberal MPs agreed this week to drop a proposal in the legislation that would have allowed police to lay charges more easily and speedily for hate speech by bypassing provincial attorney general approval. Critics had argued it gave too much power to police. Now the Liberals face a bigger challenge, and Justice Minister, Sean Fraser has refused this week to reveal the government's position. Here's what we know. What's legal now? Under Canada's criminal code, it's illegal to publicly advocate for genocide, incite hatred, or willfully promote hatred against any identifiable group. It's also illegal and willfully, let me start that sentence again because I'm going to a new page. It's also illegal to willfully promote anti-Semitism. Aside from needing to be made in public, the latter two offenses have several exemptions, including one that shields any good faith opinion on a religious subject or based on a belief in a religious text. For years, that has drawn criticism from some Jewish groups, as well as in largely secular Quebec, making its removal a long-standing priority of the separatist bloc. However, some lawyers say it's unclear if that defense has ever been used successfully to prevent hate crime prosecutions. In the landmark 1990 Keekstra ruling, which upheld the constitutionality of the willful promotion of hatred offense, the Supreme Court said the exemptions helped ensure the scope of the law was clearer and not perceived as overbroad or unduly vague, though it noted they represented situations unlikely to fall under a willful promotion of hatred anyway. It's extremely unlikely that religious exemption would ever be available, said Toronto criminal lawyer Mark Sandler. He said he worried the removal of the defense could reopen the constitutional debate about Canada's hate speech laws. I don't think that defense is needed, strictly speaking, for a section to survive constitutional scrutiny, but I'd prefer that the constitutional argument not be reopened by leaving it out, Sandler told the Star. Still, critics have argued the religious defense is a loophole in the law that could lead to hesitancy from law enforcement and prosecutors to pursue hate speech charges if it comes from a religious leader, for example. You can look at their religious texts yourself and see what they mean, but the reality is that there is an exception in the criminal code that is making people hesitate. Newly sworn in Identity and Culture Minister Mark Miller said Tuesday. And in the context of passing their hate crime bill in Parliament, some Liberals see the Bloc's desire for change as something that needs to be considered. Obviously, we have to find a solution, Quebec Liberal MP Peter Schiffke told reporters. I think in principle, it's definitely something I would support. What does the bill propose? The bill proposes a slew of criminal code revisions to combat rising hate. It proposes criminalizing, intimidating, or obstructing people from accessing places of worship, schools, and community centers, as well as outlawing the willful promotion of hatred through the display of symbols of government-designated terror groups, as well as Nazi imagery. It would also define hate in the criminal code while making hate-motivated crime a specific offense. None of the proposed offenses would have the good faith religious opinion defense, though the ban on terror symbols would exempt displays for the purpose of journalism, religion, and education or art. What happens now? Without any support in Parliament for the bill, a National Post report this week, citing an unnamed source, said the Liberals have made a deal with the Bloc to drop the religious opinion defense from the existing laws in order to shepherd their new hate crime bill through Parliament. That caused an uproar from the Conservatives, who had been blocking efforts to pass the legislation and branded it an unnecessary censorship bill that lowers the legal standard for hatred. Civil liberties advocates and pro-Palestinian advocates have also demanded the original bill be dropped, expressing fears it would be used to limit Canadians' right to protest, especially over Israel's war in Gaza. The National Council of Canadian Muslims escalated its pushback, saying in a social media post this week, it would consider a charter challenge if the Liberal government dropped the defense of good faith interpretations of religious texts, arguing it risks turning legitimate theological discourse into a criminal offense. Rob Danu, a lawyer and a former BC prosecutor, told the Star the change was a slippery slope for freedoms of religion and expression that is more likely to muzzle people's speech out of fear of repercussions than lead to more charges. Fraser did not address the proposed change this week, but has told a parliamentary committee studying the bill he sees no problem with it if there is consensus for it. His office said in a statement they remain open to constructive improvements in good faith. On Wednesday, most Liberal MPs approached by the Star said they were not aware that change was being considered, but Toronto MP Nate Erskine-Smith said he thinks we have to be careful when we impose additional restrictions on speech, while his caucus colleague Salma Zahid said she has heard from some concerns about the bill that she will raise. After months of conservative delays, we are ready to move forward on Thursday and see this legislation through, Fraser's office said in a statement. All right, the next article is titled, TTC may run ads in subway tunnels. Vancouver firm vies to install LED lights that, when viewed from a speeding train, create videos, by Andy Takagi. TTC tunnels may soon get a bit brighter and more distracting. Toronto's transit agency is looking into installing advertisements that would run inside the city's subway tunnels in time for next summer. A proposal presented to the TTC board next week could give the transit agency the green light to enter into a 15-year contract with Vancouver-based ad agency AdTrack Media. The advertising company uses a similar system to a flipbook, a system similar to a flipbook in parts of Vancouver's SkyTrain system. 360 vertical LED lights were installed into the walls of the subway tunnel that, when viewed from a speeding train, create a video. The only catch, the trains need to be running fast enough for the ads to work. The in-tunnel ad system was installed in Vancouver in 2022, and similar technology has been deployed throughout the world on other transit systems. If the TTC's deal with AdTrack Media goes through, the cash-strapped transit agency wants to target installation for summer 2026 to optimize advertising revenue opportunities during the FIFA World Cup, when Toronto will host six matches from June 12 to July 2nd. According to the TTC motion, AdTrack Media's technology complies with accessibility standards for flashing content and meets safety thresholds to protect riders from seizure-inducing visuals. The TTC did not immediately respond to a request for comment. In Vancouver, AdTract Media paid for the installation and maintenance of the technology with no expense to the local transit agency, TransLink. The exact structure of the deal depends on negotiations, but the TTC motion says the final agreement with AdTract Media would include guaranteed revenue for each tunnel ad installed, with annual top-up revenue to the TTC, and that AdTract Media would pay for the cost of installation. In 2024, the TTC drew in $31.9 million from advertising through a contract with Pattison Outdoor Advertising, which has handled all the ads in the system since 2011. That contract was extended to 2022 to run through 2033. TTC is currently facing a $33.9 million budget shortfall, due mostly to lower than expected ridership. And before I move on, I need to remind you one more time that you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The next article is titled, Report Finds More Youth Were Accused of Homicide in 2024. Statistics Canada data shows fewer killings overall across the country last year. And this is by Maya Tostonik. The number of youth charged with homicide in Canada rose in 2024 from the year before, according to newly released Statistics Canada data on homicide trends across the country last year. In 2024, the number of people under 18 years old accused of homicide was 72, according to the Statistics Canada report. That number increased by around 10% from 2023, when 65 youths were accused. The increase drove up the overall rate of youths charged with homicide from 0.87 to 0.94 per 100,000 youths. Despite the increase in 2024, the number is still below the 2022 spike of 95 youths charged with homicide, which is the highest in the last 50 years. In 2024, police also reported 13 incidents where multiple youths were charged with homicide. In five of those incidents, three or more young people were charged. Homicide is an umbrella term that encompasses charges such as first-degree murder, second-degree murder, manslaughter, and infanticide, according to Statistics Canada. In Canada, there were more than 780 homicides in 2024. That number means that out of every 100,000 people, 1.91 were a homicide victim. While the total number and rate of homicides did drop from 2023, several groups continued to be more at risk, including people from Indigenous and racialized groups and women facing violence from intimate partners. Here are the details on homicides in Canada, the groups facing the largest impacts, and the trends mean they were victims of homicide eight times more than non-Indigenous people. Indigenous women face a greater increase in homicides from 50 in 2023 to 71 in 2024. About another third of homicide victims were people from racialized communities. Black people made up 45% of the number of racialized victims. South Asian and Arab people were the second and third most effective groups, and 22% and 9%, respectively. Overall, racialized people had a homicide rate of 1.72 victims per 100,000 people. That rate is lower than that of non-racialized victims, which came to 1.98 per 100,000. Almost one in six homicide victims were killed by a spouse or intimate partner in 2024, with that number disproportionately made up of women. Overall, the number of people killed by an intimate partner rose by about 40%, from 73 victims recorded in 2023 to 100 in 2024. women made up 81% of the total victims of intimate partner homicide. Additionally, the number of women killed by an intimate partner rose around 50%, from 53 victims in 2023 to 81 in 2024. The number of men who were victims remained consistent. Homicide rates across the country. Police reported 788 homicides across Canada in 2024, which was 8 fewer than the previous year. Reflecting that downward trend, 22 of the 42 census metropolitan areas saw their homicide rates drop in 2024, but the homicide rate didn't fall in Toronto. The number of homicides in Toronto did rise by 27% from 2023 to reach a total of 80 homicides in 2024, according to data from Toronto Police. So far this year, the number of homicides has decreased by more than 50%. There have been 37 homicides in the city so far. The homicide rate in Ontario remains largely unchanged at 1.75 per 100,000 victims. Other provinces saw notable increases, including in Nova Scotia and Manitoba. The numbers also doubled in two provinces, in New Brunswick from 9 in 2023 to 18 in 2024, and in Prince Edward Island from 1 in 2023 to 2 in 2024. In Saskatchewan, the homicide rate rose by 7%. Homicide rates decreased in four provinces, including British Columbia, Alberta, Quebec, and Newfoundland, and Labrador, where the rates dropped by half. And the next article is titled, No End in Sight for Thorncliffe Park Fire. Garden hoses used to battle blaze in 50-millimeter gap, by Maya Tostonik. Toronto's fire chief said there is currently no timeline for when residents of two Thorncliffe Park condo buildings can return to their homes as crews battle the blaze that has been sandwiched between the two buildings since last week. Fire Chief Jim Jessup, along with city officials, provided an update at City Hall Wednesday about the unprecedented and extremely challenging fire that has displaced hundreds of residents, noting that firefighting operations will continue well into next week. Fire officials on Tuesday met with engineers who recommended the buildings remain empty until further notice, Jessup said, adding there is no time frame for when the fire will be extinguished. Due to the complicated nature of the blaze, Jessup said, some units adjoined to the wall that is burning have sustained significant damage as firefighters attempt to get water and extinguishing agents directly onto the burning compressed wood between the buildings. Units throughout the building have been damaged by water, smoke, and fire, he added. In the units where firefighters are currently working to access the burning material, there are also holes in the walls. We know residents are eager to return home, and we share that urgency, but safety must come first, Jessup said. Emergency crews were called to 11 Thorncliffe Park Drive around 1:30 p.m. Thursday for reports of a fire, which is believed to have started in an electrical panel or transformer. The fire spread to the neighboring condominium at 21 Overlea Boulevard through insulation between the buildings. Jessup said earlier this week he has never encountered this type of fire in his 30 years of service. The burn is spreading through an expansion joint in the walls that is nearly impossible to access and invisible to the naked eye, he said. The space in which the fire is burning is only about 25 to 50 millimeters wide, Jessup said Wednesday. Regular fire hoses are too large to access it, he said, so firefighters have had to start using garden hoses instead. We have never in the history of Toronto Fire Services experienced a fire like this, Jessup said. He added that he has contacted colleagues across North America and in the past few days, and they had also never seen anything like it. The city is supporting 239 displaced residents from 119 households, it said in an update Monday. Authorities don't know when it will be safe for them to return home. In the meantime, displaced residents are living in 131 hotel rooms across the city. The city is facilitating access to food, accommodation, financial help, and mental health services alongside the Canadian Red Cross and Community Agency and Neighborhood Organization, said Joanna Bevan Desjardins, Executive Director of Toronto Emergency Management. Residents will only be able to return once engineers determine the building is safe, said Kamal Gagna, Acting Executive Director of Toronto Building. However, engineers won't be able to conduct a thorough investigation, including toxin, structure, and fire alarm tests, until the fire has been extinguished, he said. An investigation into the cause of the fire and how it spread has been launched by fire investigators and police, Jessup said. That investigation will determine if there is a public safety concern for other high-rise buildings in the city that may contain similar materials, he said. And the next article is EQB to buy Loblaws Bank for $800 million. By Christine Dobby and Derek DeCloy. Canadian lender EQ Bank is buying the banking division of the country's largest supermarket chain to boost its deposit and credit card businesses. EQB Inc. is acquiring President's Choice Bank, along with some related insurance businesses from Loblaw Companies, for about $800 million, with most of it to be paid in shares, according to a statement Wednesday. The deal will give Loblaw a stake of at least 17% in EQB. EQ Bank has had a tumultuous year. In June, longtime chief executive Andrew Moore died suddenly at the age of 65. The bank brought back its former chief financial officer, Chadwick Westlake, to run the company. In October, the firm cut 8% of its staff. The deal with Loblaw will add $5.8 billion in assets and more than $800 million in deposits, EQB said. Okay, now I'm going to read just a couple of short articles under the title of Canada Briefs. The first one is from Alberta. Smith recall fight proceeds. A woman looking to launch a recall petition to oust Alberta Premier Danielle Smith from her seat in the legislature says her campaign has been officially approved. Heather Van Snick says she has received a letter from Elections Alberta saying she will be getting the go-ahead to start the petition drive. Once it goes ahead, it's a lengthy, multi-stage process. And from Ottawa, Freeland touts Ukraine funds. Former Federal Minister Chrystia Freeland this week said Ukraine can become an economic juggernaut and boost European economies by taking up the opportunities it missed after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Her comments come as Ottawa pledges another $235 million for Ukraine through the NATO military alliance. It is a country that will be a fantastic partner for all of us, a fantastic investment for the businesses that have the courage to invest now, Freeland said. Okay, before I go to the next article, I just want to remind you one more time that you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And the next article is titled, Union Head Calls Skills Fund Criticism Ludicrous. Labor leader defends against unfounded claims. This is by Maura Welsh. the head of a union that received millions of dollars from Ontario's $2.5 billion Skills Development Fund caused criticism of how the job training money was distributed ludicrous and ridiculous. Joseph Massinelli, Canadian director of the Labor's International Union of North America, that's LIUNA, was one of 17 leaders who endorsed Premier Doug Ford in the February election while his organization received money from the fund, including capital dollars for new training centers. Labor Minister Dave Piccini has faced a firestorm of criticism since the provincial Auditor General released a scathing report on the fund last month. Shelley Spence said payouts from the fund were not fair, transparent, or accountable, noting that hundreds of low-scoring applications received funding while higher-scoring ones were frozen out. While introducing Piccini at Toronto's Empire Club on Wednesday, Massinelli said, "Now let me deal with the elephant in the room," before launching into a defense of the Skills Fund. To say that the fund was created as a quid pro quo for unions like LIUNA because we endorsed the premier is absolutely ridiculous, since we basically endorsed the premier far before the capital grants were enacted, he said. To say that grants have been given to training centers because of quid pro quo with the premier, with the Ford government, is absolute nonsense. Massinelli said it's ludicrous some of the things that I've heard, the attacks, the unfounded attacks that have been focused and thrown at Minister Piccini and the premier, and words like corruption are words that should never be spoken in the legislature. And quite frankly, those who are speaking, those are the corrupt people, he said, as the crowd applauded and Piccini walked onto stage. Following his speech, Piccini sat for a fireside conversation with Amanda Galbraith, co-founder of Oyster, a high-stakes communication firm. Galbraith asked Piccini about the Auditor General's findings regarding the success of low-scoring applicants to the Skills Development Fund. Some applicants, he said, may not have had the sophistication to write a government application, but we want to make sure it's accessible to everyone. And the next article is under the byline, Queen's Park. Tories spent record $111 million on ads. Gravy train shows lack of respect for taxpayers, opposition critics charge. This is by Rob Ferguson. Taking aim at record spending of $111.9 million on government ads last year, critics say Premier Doug Ford is more interested in polishing his image than in helping Ontarians. The Premier used to be a fierce opponent of the government gravy train. Remember that? New Democrat leader Merritt Stiles said Wednesday in the wake of a Watchdog's report that found many of the ads were partisan at taxpayer expense. Now he's conducting it. Doot, doot, all aboard. Auditor General Shelley Spence reviewed government advertising, raising questions about the record spending in the last fiscal year, which included the campaign for the February 27 election that returned Ford's progressive conservatives to power with a rare third majority. The $111.9 million was an increase of $8.4 million from the previous year and triple the $33.7 million spent 2 years ago. Some of the ads are quite promotional for the governing party, Spence said, following the release of her 483-page report that also ripped the government on shortfalls in health care. They aren't really providing really good, solid information to the citizens of Ontario. Ford was absent from the legislature's question period Wednesday. leaving Treasury Board President Carolyn Mulroney to defend the ads, some of which appeared during expensive TV time slots during the Super Bowl and NHL games. We're going to continue to let Ontarians know about the valuable programs and services during this critical time when we're in an unjust tariff war with the United States, she said. We're telling the story of Ontario, both domestically and abroad. It's our responsibility to do that. Economic Development Minister Vic Fedeli said ads outside Canada helped lure $40 billion in investment to the province from 409 companies last year. Go to any international airport, you'll see advertising from Ontario, he said. The ads flagged by the auditor are promoting the governing party, included TV commercials from the It's Happening Here campaign, showing workers in the energy, mining, electric vehicle, and automotive manufacturing sectors. Appearing widely before the election, they boasted more people are working today than ever before, taking home bigger paychecks. Spence noted they did not include any information about government programs and services and appeared designed to improve Ontarians' impression of the current state of Ontario, the subtext of which promotes the governing party. Ford promised in the 2018 election campaign to tighten rules around government advertising after the previous Liberal government relaxed them in 2015, but he did not follow through. They do not respect taxpayers' money, said Liberal MPP John Fraser, Ottawa South. In her report, the auditor found 53% of the money, that's $59.3 million, went to American TV networks to promote trade and tourism in Ontario and counter U.S. President Donald Trump's tariffs. That cash did not include the millions spent on Ontario's Ronald Reagan ad that so provoked Trump he scuttled trade talks with Canada. That commercial did not appear until after the current fiscal year began on April 1st. The next article is titled, Prairie Chiefs Open to Pipeline Plan After Meeting PM. Support rests on Indigenous co-ownership by Alessia Passafume and David Baxter. Prime Minister Mark Carney met Wednesday with chiefs representing Treaties 6, 7, and 8 on Parliament Hill, who expressed openness to the idea of pipeline ownership days after Carney signed a memorandum of understanding with Alberta that opens the door to get one to BC's coast. Piikani Nation Chief Troy Knowlton, speaking to reporters outside the door where he and other chiefs met with Carney, said First Nations need a stake in any project proposed on their lands. We're not against economic growth or benefits to the region, to our people, to the greater population, Knowlton said. What he is against is harms to the environment and potential health impacts caused by destruction of the waterways. But if we're real co-owners, then the concerns we have, we can ensure that we're addressing those concerns, environmental health and safety, employment and recognition of the area's First Nations and ancestral places, said the chief representing a First Nation in southern Alberta. The agreement between Ottawa and Alberta commits the two governments to working toward building an oil pipeline to the West Coast and opens the door to changes to the coastal tanker band. It says Ottawa's commitment is contingent on the pipeline being approved as a project of national interest and on the project providing opportunities for Indigenous co-ownership and shared economic benefits. Despite that vague promise of Indigenous co-ownership, no First Nations leaders were consulted on what the memorandum of understanding would look like. Not even those like Knowlton who are open to the idea of one. The meeting between Carney and the chiefs came a day after the chiefs at the Assembly of First Nations Special Assembly voted unanimously to reject the agreement and to press the federal government to uphold the coastal tanker ban. Alberta does not have a regional representative at the Assembly of First Nations, and not all chiefs in the province participate in the advocacy body's functions. Chiefs in British Columbia are generally united in opposition to the removal of the tanker ban, which was passed in legislation in 2019, putting legal teeth behind a non-binding moratorium that had been in place in the region since the 1970s. It bars oil tankers carrying more than 12,500 tons of crude oil from stopping or unloading at ports from the northern tip of Vancouver Island to the Alaska border. Carney addressed the Assembly of First Nations gathering on Tuesday, where he tried to quell concerns from chiefs about the agreement with Alberta and his government's major projects agenda. Energy and Natural Resources Minister Tim Hodgson was scheduled to speak in front of the Assembly of First Nations Thursday, but was pulled from the agenda Wednesday, along with National Defense Minister David McGuinty. And I think I have time for one more short article. Clarington Councillor Charged for Threats by Moya Dillon. Clarington Councillor Corinna Trial is facing criminal charges. Peterborough Police announced on Wednesday that Trial had been charged with two counts of uttering threats. Former Clarington mayoral candidate Tom Dingwall took to Facebook in September to detail threats Trial allegedly left in a voicemail for him, demanding he step down from any future mayoral races, including alleged threats of sexual violence against his wife. In a statement released on September 8, Trail denied leaving the voicemail and claimed artificial intelligence was involved. "I want to state clearly and unequivocally, I did not create this message," Trail said in statement. Trail did not respond to a request for comment regarding the charges on Wednesday. And I will end with, you've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 4 issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Jane. Thank you for listening.